Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive. Today we're going to be looking at excerpts from session 3 of Dr. Tremper Longman's teaching series, and the title is God is a Warrior. And you know, just that title alone, I mean, it kind of got me thinking, you know, is that really how the Old Testament portrays God? It feels a little bit unexpected. So I'm really curious to see what Dr. Longman has to say about this.
Yeah, it is an intriguing concept. You know, Dr. Longman starts by pointing out that unlike many ancient Near Eastern creation stories, the creation story we see in Genesis 1 and 2 presents a God who brings order without violence, almost as if God's an artist rather than a warrior.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, it's like he's creating a masterpiece rather than conquering a foe.
Yeah.
And I guess that makes sense in a way, right?
Yeah.
Because in Genesis, God is creating something new. He's not fighting against something old.
Exactly. And that peaceful creation sets the stage for a pretty dramatic shift. Once sin enters the picture in Genesis 3, God takes on this more protective role. Think about the cherubim guarding the Garden of Eden. It's like the subtle first hint of a warrior God emerging, ready to defend what he's made.
Right. It's almost like a parent stepping in to protect their child from danger. And this idea of God as a protector, I mean, it becomes more and more pronounced as we go through the Old Testament. And I think Exodus 15.3 actually marks the first time that God is explicitly called a warrior, right?
Yes, it does. But even before that, we see hints of God's involvement in warfare. There's that fascinating story of Abraham battling those four kings in Genesis 14.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting because both Abraham and this mysterious figure, Melchizedek, they both acknowledge that God played a crucial role in Abraham's victory, even though it was Abraham who was leading the charge.
That's a really good point. You know, it shows that God doesn't always work in these obvious ways. Sometimes he's working behind the scenes, orchestrating events to bring about his purposes. And then we have the conquest of Canaan. And it all starts with this dramatic battle of Jericho. God grants this miraculous victory over this seemingly impenetrable walled city. But then, and this is where things get really interesting, the very next battle at Ai, Israel's defeated. And that kind of surprised me, I have to admit.
Yeah, it is a little bit of a twist, isn't it? Especially since Ai literally means ruin or dump. You can imagine how shocking this loss must have been for the Israelites. But Dr. Longman explains that this defeat was due to Achan's disobedience. He took some of the plunder from Jericho, which was forbidden, you know, breaking the terms of God's covenant.
So even though God is a warrior fighting for Israel, his support isn't necessarily unconditional. They have to uphold their end of the covenant as well.
Precisely. It highlights the importance of obedience and faithfulness in their relationship with God. You know, their victories aren't just about military might. They're about aligning themselves with God's will.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah.
And it makes you think about all the different ways that God might be involved in conflicts, even today. You know, working through those who are striving to live according to his will.
Yeah.
Speaking of unexpected ways of working, we come to one of my favorite stories from Judges Ehud and King Eglon.
Ah, yes. Quite a memorable story. A left-handed assassin, a secret message, and well, let's just say the details are quite vivid.
Yeah, it's almost darkly humorous.
It is.
But what really struck me was the fact that the text specifically mentions Ehud being left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like such a small detail, but it ends up being crucial to his success.
It is fascinating how God uses even the smallest details, like Ehud being left-handed to orchestrate victory. It's a reminder that God works in ways we might not expect. You know, he's not limited by our conventions or our expectations.
Yeah, it's like he sees the bigger picture, all those little pieces fitting together to achieve his purpose. And even though he's working through these flawed individuals like Ehud, he's ultimately the one securing the victory. Then we move on to the time of King David. Another example of God working through someone who's far from perfect.
Yes, there's that battle where God tells David to wait for the sound of marching on the tops of the poplar trees before attacking.
I love that. It's such a vivid image. The rustling leaves signaling the advance of God's heavenly army. It really underscores his direct involvement and guidance in warfare. It's not just about human strategy. It's about divine intervention.
Exactly. And all of these battles where God is fighting alongside Israel against human enemies. This all falls under what Dr. Longman calls phase one of God's warrior role in the Old Testament. But as we'll see in a moment, there's another side to God as a warrior that might surprise you.
Okay, so we've seen how God acts as a warrior for Israel, but you're saying there's another side to this. Like, what does that look like?
Well, Dr. Longman calls this phase two, and it's where God's warrior nature, it's actually directed against his own people.
Wow, that's a tough concept to wrap your head around. Why would God, who we've seen act as this protector and deliverer, why would he turn against his own people?
It really all comes back to that covenant relationship. Remember how we talked about God's support being conditional? Well, when Israel breaks that covenant through disobedience and unfaithfulness, they experience the consequences.
So it's like, in a sense, God's role as a warrior is about upholding the covenant, even if it means disciplining his people.
Exactly. It's about maintaining that integrity of the relationship. Think back to the story of Achan taking the forbidden plunder from Jericho. That act of disobedience, that's what led to their defeat at Agag's judgment. It was a direct response to their violation of the covenant.
Right. It's like a parent disciplining a child, not out of anger, but out of love and a desire to guide them back to the right path. But things get even more intense than just losing a battle. What about the story of the Ark of the Covenant being captured by the Philistines? I mean, that always felt like a real low point for Israel.
Absolutely. And it's almost ironic, isn't it? Eli's sons, they brought the Ark into battle, thinking that it would somehow guarantee them victory. Like it was some kind of magical charm.
Yeah.
But their actions, they reveal this really deeply flawed understanding of God's power. They forgot about the covenant, the relationship that was at the heart of their strength.
It's like they were putting their faith in an object rather than in God himself. It's a good reminder for us that even religious symbols, they can be misused if we lose sight of the true source of our strength. But the capture of the Ark, that wasn't the end. The consequences of their unfaithfulness, they escalated, didn't they?
Yes, sadly they did. The culmination of this phase two is the Babylonian exile and the destruction of Jerusalem. Dr. Longman, he points to Lamentations 2, where God is actually portrayed as an enemy laying waste to his own city. It's really powerful and unsettling imagery.
It sounds heartbreaking to think that God, who had been their warrior and protector, now appears as the instrument of their destruction. That must have been incredibly difficult for them to process.
It certainly was a time of profound grief and questioning. But even in the midst of this devastation, there's this deeper order at work. You see, Lamentations is structured as an acrostic, with each verse starting with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet.
Oh, wow. What's the significance of that structure?
Well, acrostics, they often represent order and structure, especially in ancient literature. So the fact that Lamentations is written in this very specific way while describing such utter chaos and destruction, it just emphasizes the gravity of the situation. It's like saying, look, even in this devastation, there's this deeper order at work, and it's tied to God's justice. He's not acting randomly or out of spite, but in accordance with the covenant that he made with his people.
That's a really profound point. So the destruction, it wasn't arbitrary. It was a direct consequence of their persistent unfaithfulness to the covenant.
Exactly. It's a sobering reminder that our choices have consequences and that even God's love doesn't negate the need for justice. Remember the blessings and curses we talked about earlier from Deuteronomy 28? The prophets, especially someone like Jeremiah, they were constantly reminding Israel of these consequences. They were acting as covenant lawyers, laying out the case for God's judgment.
So while this phase two is definitely difficult to grapple with, it's important to see it within the larger context of God's relationship with his people. But it's not the end of the story, though, is it? You mentioned the phase three where God's warrior nature shifts yet again. I'm really curious to hear where this goes. So we've gone from God the artist and creator to God the warrior fighting both for and against his people. This phase three you mentioned, where does this fit in? What does it mean for God the warrior to save?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's almost like we're shifting from judgment back to hope. You know, Dr. Longman highlights how some of the later prophets, they envision this future where God's warrior nature, it's focused on rescuing his people, but this time it's about liberating them from oppression. And it's not just about earthly battles or physical enemies, it's about something much bigger.
So instead of battling against Israel for their disobedience, he's battling for them against something else.
Exactly. Think of it this way. In phase one, God fights against Israel's human enemies. In phase two, he confronts their unfaithfulness, their internal struggles. But in phase three, the focus expands. It's God as a warrior against all forms of evil and injustice, ultimately leading to this new era of peace and righteousness.
Wow, that's powerful. So it's not just about restoring Israel to their land. It's about this much grander vision of salvation that encompasses all of creation.
You got it. And that vision has these really profound implications for how we understand God's character and his relationship with humanity. It raises all sorts of questions about how we as individuals and communities are called to participate in this cosmic battle against evil.
Yeah, it really makes you think, doesn't it? Knowing that God is a warrior fighting for ultimate good, it gives you this whole new perspective on how we approach conflict and justice in our own lives. As we were going through all this, was there anything that particularly resonated with you?
You know, for me, it was the reminder that God's actions are always purposeful. Even when they seem harsh or difficult for us to understand, whether he's fighting for his people against them or ultimately for their eternal salvation, there's always a deeper reason behind it. It's not about winning battles in this worldly sense. It's about achieving his ultimate purpose, which is the redemption and restoration of all things.
That's a beautiful way to put it.
Yeah.
It's a reminder that we can trust in God's wisdom and goodness, even when we don't fully understand his ways. Well, this has been a fascinating deep dive into the concept of God as a warrior. To our listener, I highly recommend checking out Session 4 of Dr. Longman's series. It's clear we've only just scratched the surface of this complex and often misunderstood aspect of God's nature. Thanks for joining us on this epic journey through the Old Testament battlefield.